Well, good evening to everyone. It's good to see you again this evening, coming back on a Sunday night. And tonight we're going to be talking about Gideon. The 11th chapter of Hebrews is a great chapter about faith. There's a lot of examples that the writer gives about what faith means. He talks about Abel, talks about Enoch, God. He talks about Abraham, Moses, Rahab, the harlot. A lot of others he'd like to talk about. He just doesn't have time, room, and space to do so. And so near the end of his examples of all the stories that he gives, he says, well, what more can I say to talk about Gideon and Barak and David and Solomon and the prophets? But first on that list is Gideon. And he can say a lot more about Gideon. We'd like for him to say a lot more about Gideon. Again, there just wasn't time to do that. Well, we are familiar probably with the story of Gideon. After the conquest of the land of Canaan, Joshua led the people. It took about 7 years to get the land conquered, and then Joshua ruled there, and the people were faithful to God as long as Joshua lived, and even the lives of the elders of that time, they were faithful. But after a period of time, they really began to away from the Word of God. And the world, the nation at that time was judged by judges, hence the book of Judges. And Gideon is one of these judges. He has two names, or three names actually. We know him as Gideon, but his name was Jerubbaal. It's easier to spell. He's also known as Jehoshaphat, and he was the youngest son of a man by the name of Joash, and he was of the tribe of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was one of the boys of Joseph, and he had, that's me doing that, actually, it's a trick that I've done, so going in and out, does that sound like
that means I can't move. And now I am going to stand here for the next 40 minutes. Okay. I love technology. The tribe of Manasseh was broken up actually into two tribes. The northern tribe was on the eastern side of the Jordan. That was called northern Manasseh. Southern Manasseh was on the western side. And he was one of the chief leaders of Manasseh, and his story is found in the book of Judges, chapters 6, 7, and 8, one of the bigger stories. What is interesting about Gideon, and maybe we didn't know this, is that Gideon's father was a devout Baal worshiper. He was also a worshiper, but he was also a worshiper. If you look in Judges chapter 6 and verse 25, we find that the father of Gideon had his own altar to Baal. It came to pass that the same night that the Lord said to him, take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it. So he didn't only have a place for Baal, he had a wooden image there also. So this is the background of Gideon. And we know in the book of Judges, it is a book of cycles. They are obedient to God, and then they decide to be disobedient to God, like Joash, Gideon's dad. And they go after idols and do those kind of things they're not supposed to do. And then God brings these oppressors in there and oppresses them for numbers of years until they cry out to the Lord, please deliver us. God sends a judge to deliver them. And so the cycle goes on and on. And prior to the story of Gideon, this has gone on for some time. It began with the oppression of the Mesopotamians. And the first judge was Othniel, and he reigned or ruled or judged for 40 years. And then the Moabites came, and Ehud did his thing. That's kind of a fun story. We talked about Ehud this morning. He was there for about 80 years. And then the local guys, Philistines, came, and they oppressed them, and Shamgar delivered them. Don't really know. The book of Judges is a little tough to do chronology because it's not like it's all in singular order. We don't really know how long Shamgar may not have been there very long. And then the Canaanites came and they oppressed the people. Then Deborah was the great. So he's like number five. But when the time of Gideon, you can see that it's been a few hundred years, give or take, and ever how this is done. And the situation was very dire. It wasn't like that they came over and said, okay, we're here. These people came and oppressed the Israelites almost like the Egyptians used to. So they had all those glorious days of Joshua's conquering the land, and then Joshua died. They went to serve wickedness, and God punished them. And for hundreds of years, these people brought all of this misery upon them time and time and time again. And that's where we find our story in Judges chapter 6, that the angel of the Lord has come to once again deliver the people, because they have cried out. And so in Judges chapter 6 and verse 11, the angel of the Lord came and sat down under the terebinth tree, which is in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abzraite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, that the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. So we know a little bit about Gideon. He is a mighty great man of valor. So what God is going to do is he's going to call Gideon and say, you get to go deliver the people. Now, he's like number five in line. And so they're a little familiar, at least with this process, that some judge comes and is going to deliver them. And Gideon is, you know, we always talk about doubting Thomas. I'm going to tell you what, Gideon is the doubting guy. Thomas was not a doubter. Thomas was a great man of faith. Gideon is the guy who wanted some proof, and so he wasn't sure how this was all going to kind of work out. God tells him that I want you to come and deliver these people. And he gives excuses. Sounds a little like Moses there in verse 15. He says, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. And he said, if I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talks with me. Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering, set it before you. And he said, I will wait until you come back. And so he goes through this process, and God shows him, yes, I am here, it's me, you know. And he proves to him, and then God proves Gideon, because now that Gideon believes that it's really him, God tells Gideon, well, I'll tell you what, son, I want you to go home, and I want you to take your daddy's altar and your the wooden image, and I want you to tear them down. Now, that's a bold thing to do. I mean, when you tell the boy, you go take care of it, because that is where he goes to worship. And so Gideon does that. Well, not only does it make his dad mad, reminds me of when my son lived across the street. You imagine how many tools I've lost. I still don't know how many I've lost. But you can imagine how that probably aggravated his dad. But do you realize that because of what he did, and you see that he has indeed done what the Lord told him to do there in verse 25, he tells him to go do that, and you come down to verse 28, and when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down and the wooden image that was beside it cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. He had done exactly what God told him to do. Do you know that not only did it make his dad mad, it started a war. The Midianites and the Amalekites got assembled and they came to take care of the problem there, you know, and it's like, wow, he just, you know, that was a big test. And in a way, this kind of helps me understand people in that region these days. And it's always been that way, and I'll tell you, it's always going to be that way. They'll go to war over little things. And he's done this, and you now have all of these down in verse 33. Then the Midianites and the Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. They come into war because this kid did what he did about his dad's idol. And then, of course, we've got the battle that's going to come on, and we know the story about Gideon and the fleece. Not only does he do it once, he does it twice. And so God kind of finally convinced him, you're the guy, I want you to go do this. And he starts out with 33,000 men. Not a bad army to start out with. I don't know how many of the Amalekites and the Midianites were there, but again, he had 33,000. He was a man of war. And then he made this, you know, it wasn't a mistake. It was just, you know, kind of what happened. This is in chapter 7. And he says to these 33,000, I tell you what, guys, listen, we're going to go to war. Some of you guys are going to die, but if you want to go home, you can. Well, you know what's going to happen, and it did. 22,000 of them are left. There's just not... did I do that math right? I just said that, and I thought, wait a minute, I think I did the math right. Let me see. Yeah, I did that wrong, didn't I? See, I did that wrong. Verse 3, 22,000 of them went home. Yeah, her. I typed that wrong. I mean, why not? 22,000, I would go home. And then God comes and says, no, I'm still not done. He goes from an army of 33,000 down to 300. And we know the great story about Gideon, how that he... You know, he really doesn't even touch anybody. They do the whole trumpet and the light thing, and they break it, and everybody gets scared, and they start killing one another. And so he has this great victory over the army, and they just wipe them all out. And so here's Gideon, and it's a wonderful story about God's providence and his power, and 300 men are able to subdue a giant army. And so it's a great story about Gideon and a great story about faith, and we could talk a lot about that. But as I was reading that story, there's one verse that sort of stuck out in my mind that it just sort of puzzled me. Because while we look at Gideon and we think about, wow, what a great story it is, when the angel of the Lord came to Gideon the first time and said, this is what we're going to do, what does Gideon say? Well, what Gideon says is this. Oh, my Lord. If the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? And now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. Wow. Where'd that come from, Gideon? I mean, really? A great man of valor. I'm not sure at this time he's a great man of faith. But before all the victories, Gideon had a complaint against the Lord. Where have you been? You made all these promises. Where have you been? You've done all these wonderful things. And he knew all the stories about how God delivered them from Egypt and the whole Red Sea thing. And he probably memorized all the battles there in the wilderness and how God fed him with the manna and fed him with the quail and gave him the water and how God destroyed Jericho and conquered the land. And he could recite to you all of those. But now we've got a man of faith who is sitting there talking to the angel of the Lord. That's the second time he mentioned him today. Did you realize that? That's kind of scary. That he's saying to him, where's God been? Okay, you're going to come and deliver us, but you know, I got a complaint. God's not been here. Because if God is with us, why has all of this happened to us? If God is such a great God, why are these things going on in our lives? Where are the miracles that he promised? Where is the power of God to take away all of these people? And really what he is saying, I'm afraid, is, well, God's forsaken us because apparently he doesn't know what's going on down here on terra firma. And it's interesting that he made, you see at the end of his statement there in verse 13, that the Lord delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. Now, if there's one thing that he got right, it's that. Because God did deliver them into the hands of the Midianites. Why? Why did God do this? Why did God allow the Midianites to come in and oppress these people for so long? And why did God allow all those things to go on? Because that we know is the fact that the only reason that any of these people come in, and you remember that it's rather kind of a great group. There's the Mesopotamians and there's the Canaanites and there's the Moabites. It's not just one group. Every time they turn around, wham, they're getting hit by these other people and these other people. And here we've got these Midianites coming up against them. And I tell you, the suffering of Gideon was real. When you read verse 1 through 6, You see what is going on in the land. The children of Israel, verse 1, did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Midian for 7 years. So, okay, this is a 7-year period of time. Keep that in your mind. 7 years of all of this. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, the strongholds which are in the mountains. And so it was that whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up. Also Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. And then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. And so Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. 7 years, these people had to live in whatever place they could go. The dens, the mountains, the caves. They couldn't even live in their own homes. And if they were able maybe to scratch out a little bit of ground here and maybe plant some crops of some kind, maybe plant some corn or some wheat, and just about time it got to be, all of a sudden here comes the Midianites. And these were not people that were going to say, well, listen, we're going to take this and you can have. They literally took it out. I mean, it's like somebody coming into your home and periodically just emptying out your refrigerator and your freezer and everything, and you have nothing. You remember that feeling some years ago, about 18 months ago, when all of a sudden there wasn't a whole lot left? You remember when the hurricanes were here and you couldn't find hardly any water and toilet paper? I'm talking about toilet paper. You couldn't find any. I mean, you know what it's like to sort of kind of live in that world. We haven't had it as bad as others. I mean, when Karen and I went to Bulgaria, I have never been in a grocery store. And I'm not exaggerating. The shelves were empty. There wasn't anything. I'm not talking about a few places. There wasn't anything. And so these people are coming in and literally taking everything you've got. Your animals, your sheep, your ox, your donkeys. I mean, you're living for 7 years. And you're thinking, where is God? What happened? Why has God forsaken us? I can understand. You're just, the first 6 months is one thing, and maybe the first year, but then you don't know how long this is going to be. And then the second year rolls around, and you're still, barely getting anything to eat. And you're the people of God. You're the people of God that He promised to give you bounty and everything that you wanted. And then we find over in Judges chapter 8 that they had killed the brothers of Gideon. Look over in chapter 8, kind of an interesting story here. This is when he's going to really subdue the Midianites. But it says, the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we may give bread to your army? So Gideon said, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Gideon kind of had an anger problem. And then he went up from there to Peniel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Peniel answered him as the man of Succoth had answered. And so he also spoke to the man of Peniel, saying, when I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower. Now Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkor. I wish they would name these things easy. And their armies with them, about 15,000, all who were left of the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. And Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Noboth and Jogbehath, and he attacked the army while the army camp felt secure. And when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle from the ascent of Heres, and he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him. He wrote down for him the letter, leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, Here are Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your weary men? And he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. What we understand that to be is one of two things, that he took literally these briars and things and he beat these guys to death with them. He either beat them to death with them or he gave them a good whipping, one or the other. The text really doesn't say, but in one, whatever it was, and there were 70, how many? 77 of them? He whipped them good with briars, and he may have killed some, I don't know. And then what did he do in verse 7? Well, he tore the tower down and killed the men of the city. So he's on a rampage here. And he says to Ziba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And so they answered, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. And as the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. And he says to Jether, his firstborn, he says, go kill him. But the young man would not draw a sword. He was afraid. He was still a youth. And so Ziba and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength. And so Gideon arose and killed them and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. Boy, that'll show them, right? They killed his brothers. I mean, it's one thing to be oppressed in a famine, but he lost family. That's what Gideon is living in. That's the kind of world. He's got a lot to complain to God about. Why'd you let my brothers die? And it was probably a very ugly way to die. Why'd you let me, my brothers and my family suffer like that? And then we go back to chapter 6 of verse 11, and we don't need to miss the point that when he is threshing out the wheat, he's doing it in a wine press. You don't thresh out wheat in a wine press. You do if you're trying to hide it. So you're out there and you're trying to, you know, you're in a famine. This thing's been going on for a few years. And you're finally got some wheat there and you're trying to, and you're having to hide it. And when they come, you have to cover it up and hope that they don't find it. Because if they don't, your family's not going to eat. He's trying to feed his family. Where is God in all of this? And I think that goes back to his complaint in verse 13. I wanted a miracle. I'm over here. We're dying over here. They're killing my family. They're always, every time we turn around, there they come. They're taking everything we've got. And he's got valid complaints, I guess. But it was real. I mean, had God forsaken them? These are the people of God. This is not supposed to be happening to the people of God. Had God withheld his power, couldn't he come down in something? I mean, after a few hundred years, couldn't he just come down and say, okay, we're done. We're going to wipe these people out and not let my people be oppressed anymore. Had God delivered them to the oppressors? Is he blaming God and saying, yes, you have done that? Was God to blame? Well, the problem with Gideon's case was he had a valid argument. Whether he knew that or not. But he was having a hard time. Life was hard. Family had suffered a lot. When you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, just leave your marker there at Judges 6. We'll come back to that in just a moment. But in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 31, this is what God said about what was going to take place with his people if they disobeyed him. Deuteronomy chapter 31 verse 16. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. And then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. And many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they had done and that they had turned to other gods. Well, Gideon was right. God had forsaken them. But the reason that God had forsaken them is because they forsook God. They had brought this misery upon themselves. And God said, I think that's such a powerful figure when he tells Moses that have not all these evils come upon us because our God is not among us. Folks, God's not among these people anymore. Because back in our text of Judges chapter 6 and verse 25, what we find is that the problem with people like Joash is he's got an altar to Baal with the wooden image at his house. A child of God with an altar to Baal and a big tall wooden statue right next to it. Kind of wonder how Gideon came out of a world like that to be a man of faith. And then back in verse 10, the Lord says that I'm the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. So yeah, the reason this is going on is because that you're not trusting in me. And I think that that speaks to the complaint that Gideon had, and I think that his complaint of, no, I don't think, but I'll tell you, the complaint that Gideon has is extremely biased. Now I get that his family's been suffering and he's been suffering. But how dare you make those kind of accusations against God? Because the reason this is going on is not because God just thought it would be a good idea, it's because of you and your lack of faith. You know, it's easy to blame God for a lot of things in this world. Gideon had made the mistake in his assumption of why bad things had come upon him. But they were actually the products of their own demise. They created this situation. And it had been going on for a number of years, a few hundred years at best. And somewhere the people were not getting the message that when you obey me, you'll be blessed. But you need to trust in me, even if things are bad. And it doesn't mean that if we are always obedient to God, it's always going to be perfect. That's not true either. So often in this health, wealth, and whatever kind of religion that people like to draw themselves to is if you are faithful to God, you're going to be healthy and wealthy. That's nonsense. There are too many godly people that have suffered some pretty horrible things. And may I say this carefully, nobody has a right to blame God for this. Nobody has a right to accuse God. And in a sense, I think that what Gideon is doing is accusing God. If the Lord is with us, what do you mean if the Lord is with us? Where do you think he is? How dare you make an accusation against God? Now, sin will bring its own penalty. The very fact that there are people who suffer things simply because they have created their own misery by the rejection. I mean, sin has that way about it. There is a consequence of sin so often that brings its own misery. The wise man said in Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 27, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. You can't walk on coals and your feet not get burned. If you play with sin, you're going to get bit. I'm going to tell you, one of the reasons I don't play with snakes is because I don't want to get bit. The only way I play with snakes is with buckshot and a .357 Magnum, .44 Magnum. I don't care what it is. Die. You play with snakes, you're going to get bit. And you play with sin, you're going to suffer consequences. And I get, you know, sure, Gideon suffered some pretty terrible things. The Midianites had killed his brothers. Where was God? Where was God when that happened? People get angry with God when a loved one is diagnosed with cancer or they die unexpectedly. And they want to blame God and say, where's God? Where's he at in all of this? I mean, when misery and pain and suffering comes upon us, much even in the flavor of Gideon, we want to think, well, God has abandoned us. See, God is not here anymore. God has left us. God is not there. I mean, where is God in the midst of all of our troubles and all of our trials that we get? I mean, has God abandoned us? No. There's a cartoon that some years ago, if you remember the Theophilus cartoon. I love the Theophilus cartoon. I think maybe in a couple of months I'm going to run the series again. It's a great series of cartoons. But it pictured a man at a funeral, and he's saying he's gone. And the caption reads, where was God when my son died, Theophilus? To which he replies, he was right where he was when his own son died on the cross. It's easy to blame God and say it's his fault. Where do you think God's been? I mean, Gideon thought that God had abandoned them. Well, he had removed his presence because of their sin, but God does not abandon his people. And the question really is that where do we turn to when life becomes unbearable? The lesson that Gideon had, which is a good lesson, which is why he's in the chapter of faith in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, was because Gideon became a man of faith. He was having a struggle with his faith now because things were hard and life was unbearable and it was unfair and he didn't really like the way things were turning out. Because he wanted to know where was God and why has he not fixed this problem? As even the Apostle Paul explained in his second letter to Corinth in the 12th chapter in verse 7. Remember the whole thorn of the flesh thing? And when lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation, the thorn of the flesh was given to me and a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. And concerning the saying, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might be removed. And God said, no. 3 times. Lord, I need you to... No. Lord, you really need it? No. Lord, you don't understand? No. It ain't going to happen. My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Do you realize that that didn't go away? And I can only assume that whatever that thorn of the flesh was, it didn't go away until he died. Well, where's God in all of this? God, Paul can say, well, listen, this is not fair. I can do so much and I can maybe be more for the kingdom of God. Whatever it was, God said no. Because he said, most gladly, I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon us. Therefore, I take pleasures in infirmities and in reproaches and needs and in persecutions and distresses. Here's the thing. I think in Gideon's life, he was really bothered by the infirmities and the reproaches and the needs and the persecutions and the distresses. And he cried out to God, where are you? And that's easy to do. We all do that. We have infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses. And guess what? Life isn't fair. Never has been, never will be. If you read the book of Ecclesiastes, as we've said numerous times before, the book of Ecclesiastes is simple. Life is hard and you die. And none of it's fair. The thing that Gideon had a hard time learning was how to really trust in God. And our outlook of life has got to come from our outlook. And I think that one of the things that happened with Gideon was that he was struggling in his faith and then God kept showing his power in him. And when he defeated the Midianites, he understood how powerful God was because he did it with 300 men and they didn't do anything. They just broke some lamps and held some, you know, blew some horns. 300! And what Gideon saw was that there was something about the promises of God and believing. Now, this doesn't suggest that it was a great time because it was still a time of oppression, a time of hardship. But he learned to trust in the Lord to accomplish great things. Do you know why the whole story about 33,000 down to 300 came about? Go back to your text of Judges. Let's go to chapter 7. Gideon learned to trust in the Lord to accomplish great things because here's why. Now, he's got these whole Midianites and the Amalekites out there. He's got about 33,000 men and he's feeling pretty good. Imagine what it was when God comes to him and says, you got a problem. And Gideon says, what's my problem? And God says, you got too many men. He's thinking 33,000 is too many. I mean, they probably got 100, they got how many? 120 some thousand that we know died. So it's really, but what happens in Gideon, in Judges chapter 7 verse 2 is that the Lord says to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. There's where I think the problem really lies. begins with Gideon saying, where is God? Well, God hadn't gone anywhere. He's still there. And you're still going to win a victory through the power of God. And one of the things that God does with him is he takes away that huge amount of army. Leaves him with 300 men. Can you imagine going to war with 300 men against the innumerable host out there of people? And yet he is saying, you need to trust in me. I love the story in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 11 and 12. Asa the king gets a notice that the Ethiopian army has come to fight. What's the first question you always ask when you hear an army's come against you? How big is their army? Do you know how many Ethiopians came to fight Asa? 1 million soldiers. That's not an exaggeration. That is in the book. 1 million men are over there getting ready to eat your bacon. They have got, I didn't really understand this part. They only had 300 chariots. I guess a lot of people didn't know how to drive or something, but still, 300 chariots is a pretty powerful. 1 million people. And if you read that story in 2 Chronicles 14, verse 11 and 12, Asa and his army defeats 1 million. How do you do that? You trust in God. And I like what Zechariah said. This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And that's what Gideon had to learn. You're under oppression for 7 years. God's not gone anywhere. Don't blame God for this. Don't act like he's the one who's the result of all of this. I'm still here. COVID's been tough. And it ain't over yet. And I kind of wondered when I was studying this, I thought, wow, 7 years, huh? Could we handle another 5 and a half, whatever that is? Are we going to blame God and say, where's God? Folks, God's not going anywhere. And there's been some hardships and there's been some difficulty, but God has not gone anywhere. And it may get worse. I don't know. I hope not. But God still hasn't gone anywhere. If we're not as close to God as we used to be, God's not the one that moved. If our faith is not as great as it used to be, God's not the one that's moved. If we don't have greater dedication to the Lord today, it's not God who's moved out of place. He's not gone anywhere. And whatever and however this comes about, it is still by the power of God. Gideon's complaint is a lesson that we don't need to be discouraged. We don't need to stop working because we're going through some hard times. Effectively, what this mighty man of valor was doing was beating wheat. God comes to a man of valor and says, what are you doing beating wheat? You need to get out there and lead an army against the enemy. Gideon apparently didn't think of that. We don't need to be discouraged. There is a lot of work that still needs to be done. God is still caring for us, and God is still taking care of us. And life may not be fair like we want it to be, but God hasn't gone anywhere. And in all kindness, if all else fails and death is a welcome release, why is that such a bad thing? Sometimes I hear people say, well, you know, doing this is better than the alternative. Really? Folks, the alternative is what's better. Paul said in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 20, his problem that according to his earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I should be ashamed, but with all boldness as always, saying, now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, but to die is gain. But if I live on the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor, yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. The point is this. Life is tough. Life is hard. There are things that go on that we're not really crazy about, and it's been challenging in the last couple of years. But I wanted to make my faith greater, my devotion stronger. I'm not going backwards. I'm going forward. And I believe in the power of God. And I know one day I'm going to die. That's an inevitable. I don't know why we act like we're not going to. My brethren, death is gain. It's sad to hear about people who have died. I knew when we learned about Dee Bowman dying. Somebody said the world is darker. And I thought, no, it's not. When people like that die, the world's not darker, it's brighter. Because here's a man of God who received the glory. But whatever life brings, and however much time we have left upon the face of this earth, either between our own demise or the coming of the Lord, God be praised, we got armies to fight. And we can do it with 300. We can make the Midianites run. The Amalekites, not a problem. Bring on the Mesopotamians. You got some Canaanites, taking them out. There's work yet to be done. Why? Because God's still there. And that's why we can say with the Apostle Paul, I am already being poured out as a drink offering. And the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the fight, the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And finally, folks, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, is going to give me on that day. And he's not only going to give it to me, but he's going to give it to everybody who loved his appearing. And I love to think about the appearing of Jesus one day. Be a Gideon. Learn to trust in God. Fight the good fight. And one day we get to go home to be with him. Consider these things as together we stand, as we sing.